Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Grilling JR with the one and only Jim Ross. Jim, what's going on, man? How are you?
I am so good, Conrad. I should be twins, but I'm not. I'm fat enough to be a twin, but I am working on that. But I am doing good, man. I'm healthy, blessed. I'm with you today and all the folks out there listening. We appreciate them so much. Our show's killing it. Better than I ever anticipated, but I like to think it's because we're providing good content and the folks are reacting to it, telling their friends about it. And so with all that said, you know, we're kicking ass and I like it.
Man, it's been a lot of fun. We had more than 200,000 people check out last week's episode and we got great feedback from that. We hope you enjoyed it and we're glad that you're with us today. We're going to be talking about one of the all-time greats and the great American dream, Dusty Rhodes. I guess let's just start at the beginning. When did you first meet Dusty? Do you remember?
Yeah, I met Dusty in April of 1978. And he was wrestling. Cowboy Bill Watts booked him to come in for the big Superdome show. And the Superdome show did real well. Did over 20,000 paid as a real number. So even though the athletic commission in Louisiana has been rumored to be somewhat dubious, shall we say, the number that for tax purposes was accurate. So 20,000 plus, a big house in those days. But Dusty wrestled in the main event. He went on 10th in a 10-match card, and he lost to Harley Race for the NWA title by disqualification. So I met Dream going into that, and we renewed our relationship not a few years later, kind of had an interruption there as far as he was in one territory and I was in another. But I met him again before the Jim Crockett Senior Tag Team Tournament down in the Superdome. Dusty booked it, and with Watts's assistance. Nobody listen to the show now. Go tell Cowboy that JR said that you were Dusty's assistant. That Watts and Crockett were partners, but Jimmy Crockett didn't book the card, and Bill didn't book the card. They had influence on how they. It's easy how you book a pro wrestling tournament. You book the very last thing you want to see. Who do you want to win it? And you book backwards, and create your matchups and this little thing where you can shoot an angle somewhere in a car to take you to another event. There's a science to it, and Dusty understood that very well. So that was the first time. April 1978. Damn, Conrad, it's been a long time ago.
It is a long time ago. There's a quote from you in Dusty's book. Dusty has a passion for the business and an obsession to be successful. The Dream has always treated me respectfully and fairly, and I don't recall ever having a harsh word with him, even though we did not always agree on creative direction. What can you expect? I'm a Longhorn, or he's a Longhorn, and I'm a Sooner. Chat me up here. You know, it's rare in wrestling that people don't have harsh words. It feels like wrestling sort of breeds paranoia, and that leads to guys to use the phrase burying one another. Maybe not always to their face, but certainly in a whisper campaign. Why do you think that never happened with you and Dusty?
Oh golly, I think our relationship went beyond wrestling. By far. And there were periods of time, especially I'd say the last 10 years of his life, that wrestling was not this topic we normally discussed. It was football. It was family. It was him going deer hunting. It was me making barbecue sauce. It was just stuff like that, that we connected on. But wrestling is so subjective. You know, one of the worst questions you can ask somebody at Q&A, and speaking of Q&A's, that one in Jacksonville coming up and also Philadelphia, is that if you ask me what my favorite wrestler is or my favorite match, I will not give you an answer because I don't know. It's like saying, who's the best this or the best that? it's a subjective craft, totally. And there's no judging system, Conrad. So, you know, Dusty and I we did disagree on storylines and angles. Not as much that as it was that, but not more so the people that were cast in those roles. Sometimes he and I would have a difference of opinion on a talent. I don't even remember any off the top of my head, but because they weren't that big a deal. I thought this guy would be better at this role than this guy. And sometimes he would consider and do it. But more often than not, he's going to ride the horse that he saddled up and came into camp with. And so then it's my job as his announcer to make that work. And because I did not hold any animosity. Go back and listen to my work in that era. I mean, sometimes I was so goddamn over-caffeinated, I could have run to L.A. from Oklahoma almost. But you know what I mean. I embellish. I'm a wrestling announcer. Of course I embellish. So that was the deal. We just never disagreed to the extent that it got personal. I think that's one thing. I didn't want his job. He didn't want mine. We enjoyed each other's company. He was a great a fan of nostalgia in everything. Baseball, NFL, especially college football, and anything involving the Texas Longhorns. And so we would talk about stuff like that, and we had great conversations. I always thought, you know, if Dusty was still alive today, Conrad, he would be great on a podcast like this, telling his stories of his journey.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was amazing, amazing storyteller.
I think Dusty Rhodes and Bobby Heenan would probably have, you know, the two best podcasts ever. You know, it's unfortunate that we never had an opportunity to do that. Let's talk about real life for a minute. You said we had more in common than just wrestling. And Dusty has often said that you guys would drink beer together and talk football. Did you ever go to any games with Dusty?
Never went to a game with him. I was at games that he was attending, but we never sat together at a game. He went to his big game all year was the Oklahoma Texas game, which he would promptly correct me by saying, "No, Sina, it's the Texas Oklahoma game."
Right.
Okay. So that was that's his deal. I got it. So Dusty and Cowboy Bill Watts, a good story here. They went to the OU Texas game, and of course, there's always an old Cotton Bowl in Dallas. Second Saturday in October, which ties into another story later on. And I don't remember which team lost. I want to believe it was Oklahoma got beat by Texas. And so Dusty and Bill were together, and Watts got some high-dollar seats from OU and all that stuff, 50-yard line, the primo stuff. And they drank beer. They landed that morning early and started eating chili dogs. And this is all a part of a big plan. They wanted chili dogs with beans in the chili because Watts and Dusty are, without a doubt, maybe Andre, if Andre, Cowboy, and Dusty were a six-man farting team, they would be undefeated for life. So here they are drinking beer in DFW airport early morning. They met there coming in from where they were coming in from. They might've been working a town for Bill. And, so they get to the state, the game's at 2:30. So they've been drinking a long time. Fast forward to the game's over. OU loses. Cowboys pissed off. Of course, the referee screwed them. Everybody in our Defiant Society, if their team doesn't win, it's all about the referees. I saw a thing on Headline News about that fight in, I think it was in, I can't remember, California, Florida, a little league fight. It wasn't a players fighting, it was their parents, and they're pissed off at the 13-year-old umpire. And I'm thinking, you've got to be shitting me. Are you egomaniacs that insecure in your goddamn life that you got to act like asses in front of your children and the children's mothers? It's just silly. But Cowboy was violent that when he got to drinking and provoked. Well, some Texas fan saw Dusty. Dusty, of course, had on something orange, cap or something. Cowboy had his cowboy hat on. Hello. And so they hit the cowboy. They got in his face, did something. And Bill didn't say one fucking word. He just knocked the guy out. Boom. Right between the eyes. So then an OU fan sees it. He runs over and starts popping off to get the fallen Longhorn. And then Dusty knocks him out. So now they're one-upping each other. who can do the most one punch knockouts on the old Cotton Bowl during the Texas State Fair, surrounded by turkey legs and corn dogs and cotton candy. So it became quite the melee. The cops came, obviously. They're all over the place anyway. They come. They see it's Dusty. They see it's Cowboy. They're wrestling fans. Then they basically encouraged Dusty and Bill to disappear amongst the crowd. And they did. Didn't get arrested. I don't know how the other guys held up, but it was just knockout after knockout. So if Cowboy had not knocked out the Longhorn guy, there's no way Dusty would have followed suit just for the hell of it. But he did. And they got their first round knockouts, and some other guys got roughed up, but that's a Dusty football story. He loved those Longhorns, man. And he hated my team. So that was a pause, you'd say, for great conversation. And the only thing I regret about all my years with Dream was I just wish we'd taken more car trips together, because that would have fleshed out more of these stories.
Let's talk about when you guys start really working together. I think that probably happens when Bill Watts sells the UWF to Jim Crockett in 87. Were you mm-hmm. talking to Dusty when that deal is being brokered, or are you doing that deal directly with the Crocketts and Dusty's not involved?
Dusty's not involved in that one. I didn't. It was a spur of the moment idea anyway. You know, I was flying. I was going to fly in Watts's plane with a pilot, by the way, folks. And to meet Jimmy and Rob Garner in Atlanta at Millionaire, I think, out there, one of those private things. And so before I left the office there in Bixby, because our plane was stored there, his plane was stored there near Bixby, I said, hey, this is an off-the-wall idea, but Bill Watts was in a gnarly mood, and he was burnt out. He was unhappy in life, and you know, he didn't need to be a people person and do that in that role. You got to be a people person, because you're asking highly motivated alpha males to work with no contract. So you better be a damn good communicator. You better be a good paymaster, and you better be a good listener. And Bill, the listening part and the communicating part was somewhat eroding. And of course, the boys are always going to bitch about their payoffs. That's just part of the game. So I said, hey, what would it take to buy this company? Why do you ask? I said, well, I'm going to talk to Crockett. He's wanting to grow. He's trying to compete with McMahon, which is a big mistake, by the way. He's trying to compete with McMahon, and he might want to buy our assets. We had 121 TV stations. So, and we had some good talent. So he told me a number. And I took it to Crockett in the same strategy. We talked about the co-ventures, pooling our resources on TVs, local TVs, promoting big events at major venues, maybe doing a few stadium shows if it worked out, so forth and so on. The Superdome was always in the picture because Watts could get access to the Superdome and nobody else could in wrestling, because he had the only booking license in the state. How that is, good politics, but it is what it is in Louisiana. It's a different world. So I met with Jimmy and I pitched the deal, and it was not a matter of, you know, him and Watts had never got along for whatever reason, but then they became best buddies over the next 72 hours. Cause I said, you know, you talk to Bill, work out the details. He's willing to sell. And I said, Jimmy, I'm just going to tell you, we got 121 TV stations. Somebody is going to acquire the assets. He wants out. So, said Jimmy could put two and two together. The other somebody was probably Vince.
Right.
We never talked to Vince because Crockett didn't let us. I agreed on Bill's behalf to keep this deal in place for, I think, maybe 2 days. Think about a couple of days. Then if you're interested and you want to move forward, even though you want to move forward deliberately, let me know. And we won't be shopping it anywhere else. So that happened. And then we bought it out. Or they bought it out, rather, and Dusty and I started working very closely together. So that was, I remember what year that was. Was that 87 or?
Yeah, 87. That's right.
Yeah. And so from 87 on, there was really not any long intervals that Dusty and JR weren't joined to the hip to some degree. But I it was great. You know, I enjoyed it. I saw a side of Dusty that I had seen in Bill years ago, and you can trace all that back. Dusty's foundation of booking came through Eddie Grail and Cowboy. And it was Cowboy that, I think turned Dusty babyface in Florida, I guess the Deadly Korean Pak Song Nam or somebody like that. And, but they were very influential to Dusty. So I met Eddie Graham and I worked for Cowboy. And I could see all that real clear. So I knew that Dusty and I were going to philosophically have many more agreements than not.
Let's talk a little bit about Dusty's reputation as a booker. When you come in, you know, for better or worse, people have been critical of his booking. And I think it goes without saying that, most of the success that the Crockett's enjoyed was due to Dusty. But I guess if you're going to give him credit for the pluses, you got to talk about the minuses. And some of that sort of comes to a head about a year later when Jim Crockett sells to Ted Turner. So roughly a year after the acquisition goes down, he finds himself, putting up a for sale sign for Turner, and Dusty would write, "My job was not to sit in there with Dave Johnson and tell Jimmy Crockett you're $5 million in debt. Like anybody in my position, I thought he would let us know if we could afford things or not financially. At the very least, he should have told the owner of the company, but Johnson waited 1 year to tell Jimmy, one fucking year. And back then Crockett knew $5 million for a company as big as we were was a big fucking hole to be in. While he got a hell of a deal from Turner at that time, Jimmy Crockett came to me and said, 'I want out of Charlotte. I want us to move this.' I said, 'Okay, I'll go with you because that's home for me.' It was not me who said we needed to move our operations to Dallas. Deep down, I really believed he wanted to get away from the family thing. So he made that decision. Every financial decision that was made, he made. So as far as I'm concerned, the fall of Jim Crockett Promotions was partly due to the way Jimmy handled the inner workings of his family business and the way he financially mismanaged the office. We didn't need three secretaries who had been there forever." So he's pretty opinionated, and Dusty later in life would take it very personal when people would sort of wag their finger and say, "Oh, you killed Jim Crockett Promotions." And he had this type of response, but a lot of people would sort of confuse the two and say that they're intertwined. What we would see creatively in front of the camera with a quote unquote Dusty finish, or maybe Dusty putting himself on top. You hear those criticisms all the time, but behind the scenes, maybe the best financial decisions weren't being made. You were there for this. What's your take?
I agree with Dusty in this respect that, Crockett found himself in a hole that he could not dig out of. And, the problem was that, Dave Johnson, who I only met a few times, the chief bean counter, he kept all that stuff a secret. And I don't know if he did it to protect his own ass or he felt bad for the Crockett family. I don't know. Whatever his reasons were, they were wrong, because you can't allow this to happen. If you're the CFO, you understand less revenues. You understand that, but the creative might not have been what you would do, whatever. But you got to be open and honest with your boss. That's always a good policy in life. Be open and honest. Yes, you got to remember what you said last time. It's tell the truth. And so that hurt. I think that it's a strange situation. I thought that Crockett had, under Dusty's guidance, had a really good roster. And then, you know, they had the ability to add some UWF guys, which they eventually did, I think begrudgingly. And I don't understand that. It's like, Dusty, when we'll talk about it soon, but like Dusty going to WWE and becoming, the common man. Vince likes to recreate or create his own, develop his own intellectual property. But, you know, Dusty was a little bit the same way too. He wanted to be in control of, you know, he needed to be in control of all the creative as a booker, and including bringing guys in that if they weren't a big star, like if he brought in Rouge or Brody, let's say, hypothetically, he wouldn't change Frank's name. Cause he had a great name identity. So a lot of those bookers are just that way. Cowboy's a little bit that way. So, you know, it wasn't Dusty's fault in that regard. But the booking, I think more guys should have gotten a chance to run with a ball, but he didn't have confidence in them. That's what it was. He didn't hate people, but he was very particular, much like Vince is now. You look at McMahon's thing now, and they got some great, great talents that aren't doing nothing with.
Right.
And those talents are not doing a hell of a lot for themselves to get over, because I said here on the show before, people made a big deal out of it. Well, JR said, hey, JR's just giving you an opinion, folks. That's all. I'd like to think it's an educated opinion. That's all I'm doing. Honesty and an educated opinion. But, you know, you got to let the dogs run, and you got to let people fail. And you can't wait. It don't work the other way around. So, but Dusty was a little bit like that. Watts is a little bit like that. Those bookers they know how fragile those top spots are, and how those top spots, if they crumble, you got to start all over. You do if you don't plan long term, and you do if you're trying to be one dimensional. So that was kind of Dusty's situation there. A lot of those guys and one of the reasons he was on top so much, more often than not, he drew money and was a great promo and could talk people in the seats for other matches on the same card. And he was a unique talent in that regard. My only disagreement might be that newer guys should have been given the ball, even if it's on a small, like a package of plays, a nice hot underneath angle, a nice hot semi-main deal. See if it gets over. See if they get over. And if they get over, you can evolve them up the card. But you don't know if they're just booked with another guy. This doesn't work.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Let's talk about the end of Dusty and Jim Crockett. At the end of 88, Dusty's going to do an angle with the Road Warriors, and the Road Warriors are now heels, and they're going to beat him up and put a spike in his eye, which completely violates the standards and practices for TBS at the time when it came to graphic violence and foreign objects. Because of this, Dusty's fired, and it's a pretty memorable angle. I remember when I first got into tape trading in either 96 or 97, everybody was still talking about this from 1988. What do you remember about the incident and more importantly, the fallout from it?
Well, whether we agree or not with the standards and practices policy of Turner Broadcasting at that time, it doesn't matter because it was a policy. We were made aware of it. They wanted us to refrain from as much violence that would precipitate blood. And they made it very clear. So, Dusty, I'm still scratching my head on this one. I don't know why he did it. He knew the consequences. He knew exactly what they were probably going to do if he violated a direct order from your commanding officer, so to speak. So I just didn't understand. It was graphic as hell. I mean, it was, you know, scary, and you know, the spike in the eye, and all the, he bled on national TV. He had bled on national TV before, but the rules had changed. So I never understood that, why he did that, Conrad. It was a head scratcher. I just figured he was going to run a bluff. He's going to see if they could get by with it, and you could apologize and tell them you're not going to do it again. But still benefit off the angle. But, they didn't give him a chance to do that. He was gone. And it was sad around there too. Cause you know, Dusty was like most wrestlers. They're not amazing time managers from a businessman perspective. And Dusty was no different. And you know, the best one I've been around as far as time management is concerned was Cowboy. He's better than Vince as time management is concerned, and booking ahead, long-term planning. But of course he didn't answer to a board. He wasn't a publicly traded company. He didn't have a huge staff. He had a few of us. And so Dusty, I thought, well, Dusty's got a gig someplace. He's got a better deal, but it didn't work out that way.
How did you find out that he was fired? Is it something that happens that day, or, you know, does he come into the office on Monday and is given the news, or what's the process like for the fallout?
As best I recall, he got the news from Jim Herd. Jim Herd, I think, was the head honcho at that point in time. The first head honcho of WCW when they bought Crockett out, because Herd was a buddy of Jack Petrick. They both had, you know, were St. Louis guys. And TV guys there, local TV. And so they've been buddies for 20 something years before Herd ever got to Atlanta. That was kind of an inside job. He got his, Peter got his buddy a job in a story. Was he qualified? No. Was he stuck in his ways and hard headed? Oh, hell yeah. And, you know, so my relationship with Herd was unique, to say the least. And I can explain that later, but nonetheless, I think it was right away. I don't know that Dusty even came to the office. He may have gotten a call. I wish I had the definitive, but here's the point. The point is, as soon as the higher ups saw it on TV, and I'm sure that most of them that did not watch wrestling was showed the clip simply because of the graphic nature of it and it violating the company policy. And to get Dusty in trouble or whomever was responsible. So, you know, you're not going to fire Herd who just got there. I think he's not been there too long. Peter's going to protect him. And I don't know that Herd knew what Dusty's going to do either. So Dusty was his deal. He fell on his own sword and hoping for the best, as I outlined earlier. But it didn't happen that way. I'm not sure he even came to the office because I remember going to the office. And Janie Engel, who was a secretary, assistant there for WCW forever, what a wonderful lady. She lives down in Texas. That's her only problem. But she's a wonderful human being. And she was very close to Dusty. And I went in and somebody said, did you hear what? Because it wasn't the internet then. It was, people nowadays can't even understand that. But there was no texting, I don't think. At least I didn't text. I don't think I did. There sure as hell wasn't social media like it is now where you can't exhale. JR just exhaled and Norman did, you know, hashtag exhale. So she said, did you hear the news? And I said, usually when somebody in wrestling says, did you hear the news?
It ain't good.
No, it's about a death.
Right.
And I know the office was kind of I'm thinking that's what it was, but everybody was very solemn. And I said, what is it? Dusty got fired this morning. So I went to his office, and as best I recall, his office stuff is still there.
Right.
So I'm of the belief, Conrad, he got a phone call on that thing, or it was a very short meeting in and out, and they were sending him stuff.
Let me ask you, do you think, but you know, I think it's fair to say, based on the way you've classified this was an act of defiance from Dusty, right?
Seems like it.
So if that's the case, do you think Jim Herd had already seen other similar things and realized, man, this guy just, you know, he didn't want to get with the program. He didn't want to sort of toe the company line. He wants to march to the beat of his own drummer or whatever. If I can't get him in line, I need to get him gone. And he was looking for an opportunity to maybe slide Petrick in, and then Dusty gave it to him with this angle on TBS.
It could have been, and that's a good point. Could have been. But the egregious nature of the violation of company policy in such a massive, with such a massive audience, on, you know, on TV, and hugely promoted and underscored and embellished, so forth and so on. I think that one thing there would have been enough. And if Hurd wasn't totally happy with Dusty, and I don't think they ever had a great rapport, they didn't gel. They didn't click. I clicked with Hurd a little bit, but I understood I ate a lot of shit too. You learn to eat a lot of shit in this wrestling business from your higher ups. So I don't think Dusty and him Hurd ever clicked. You know, all they thought Hurd was just a Pizza Hut guy, former Pizza Hut guy, whatever. And there's a lot of truth to that, but they never clicked. They never had a relationship to any degree. And Hurd had a way of alienating people. He was gruff, and he would change his mind by the time he left your office to his. You know, he's just, it was hard to work for, very hard to work for. And the sad part about it, and guys who are out there listening to this are in sales, or are dealing with the public, you know, product knowledge is essential. It's not an option. And in wrestling, well, there's so many nuances and things you definitively don't want to do as a rule. If you don't know those things, you have a way of unofficially endorsing them. And with that said, you're doing things that are they're just not, don't make any sense. So Hurd didn't know any of those nuances. Hurd's wrestling connection was as a lunch partner from time to time with an elderly Sam Muchnick. Sam Muchnick was also in St. Louis. Hurd was his buddy. They did some, you know, Hurd's TV station, I think, carried Sam's wrestling. So they were buddies there. But that was his conduit. And he, I remember him telling me a few times, well, I'm going home this weekend. He went home, Hurd went home every weekend. He had a little apartment there in Atlanta. I never went to his apartment, but I know he had an apartment there. And he said, I'm going to talk to Sam this weekend about this matter. I'm thinking, what the fuck? Hey, I ain't nobody got more respect for Sam Muchnick than me. But God dang, at that time he was in his 80s. He's not even watching wrestling. He don't even know these talents you're talking about. So, because I asked Sam a couple questions about that. How would you handle this? How would you handle that? And his big common answer was about two sentences. Everything was like 6 degrees from Luthez. And I love Luthez too, but that's like saying, you know, well, here, kid, I want you to watch these tapes of Babe Ruth hit a baseball and do what he does. Well, the pitching's different. The bats are different. The ball's different. Things are different. So I think that's kind of where that came in. No relationship with Hurd. And that's Hurd's problem, too. You got a highly motivated, sensitive Dusty Rhodes. You do everything you can to ingratiate yourself to him and establish a positive relationship, because as many of Booker's ideas will fail, then they will work.
Right.
And you gotta understand how do you get them out of the doldrums when they hit a stinker.
Let's keep it moving here and talk about what Dusty did once he leaves Jim Crockett. He goes to Florida, where he'd had a lot of his initial success working with the Grahams, and he's gonna form his own promotion. And he gets Mike Graham involved, and he gets Gordon Solie involved, but ultimately it becomes a money loser, and that is identified fairly quickly. And he has an opportunity to go to the WWF. You know, it's interesting that we're talking about Dusty sort of starting his own promotion. Fast forward 30 years and his son is doing the same thing. Did you have any conversations with Dusty about starting his own promotion and why he felt like that was the right move rather than just going straight to Vince?
Well, yes, it was a alpha male thing again. You know, he's used to being his own boss, and calling all the shots and not having to ask anybody what they thought about this angle for the main event or whatever. I think he was seeking that creative freedom and the independence to sit in that big chair. And the way he could do it, facilitate that at that particular time was to create his own playground. And that's what he tried to do back in Florida and recreate history.
Let's also talk about, you know, when he gets to work with Vince, a lot of people have a strong opinion about what they did there. Dusty would write, "But when Vince had Bruce Pritchard produce a series of mini videos for TV to show me working in different jobs, like a coal miner in Pittsburgh and being the common man, all that kept going through my mind was, this is the American dream with a new name. I realized this was all designed to prove to the world that he could take a guy who was the biggest star in the country and just make him into whatever he wanted." And Meltzer would say that the gimmick was to humiliate him. The old Dusty Rhodes, even though not looking like a matinee idol, still acted like a ladies man. And with all of his charm and being a true larger than life superstar, he pulled it off. Rhodes had super appeal to blacks and would talk about getting him some brown sugar, the idea of having sex with a hot young black woman. One would think in the South in the 70s that no white babyface would dare tease the idea of an interracial relationship, let alone a white babyface who almost played black. But Rhodes' appeal cut across all racial lines. He was huge with minorities, and he'd talk about his fans being black, white, green, red, and yellow. So McMahon put him in polka dots, had him dancing, and put a heavyset 55-year-old black woman, as opposed to the young hot women Dusty would talk about, as his sidekick. When you first see, when do you know what Vince's plans are? Of course, you're still working for Turner. Do you see it on TV when everybody else does? Or are you guys in communication and he says, "Jimmy, you ain't going to believe this"?
No, I saw it on television. I don't think he wanted, I brought it up to him and years later, maybe after six or eight beers or after a Texas win at the Cotton Bowl or something. And just to bullshit with him about those polka dots. And, you know, he'd look at you like, "All right, I know, go ahead, go ahead." So, you know, he knew what was happening. Yeah, it was a, you got to wonder what the motivation for that was. People say, "Well, it's Vince." Okay, we got that, folks. We got that. Of course it was Vince. You think it was Howard Finkel? No, Howard didn't have anything to do with it. I'm being facetious, but my actual question, why would Vince want to humiliate Dusty? Or was all about Vince proving that he could change even the biggest of stars into something that was more readily accessible in Vince's imagination. And he could do it with anybody, anytime. Because I wouldn't change. Why would you change 25 years of heavy duty marketing for a name if you're buying a product? And that's what Dusty was, a product. He had great name identity as Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. He was everything that you wanted this common man character to be, but just change the name because you can. Bad reason, bad logic. So Dusty did not talk about that a lot. Here's the thing, man. People said, "Well, why did he do it?" Let me tell you why he did it. He did it to feed his family.
Right.
He did it to provide his family a roof, groceries, educations, and think, you know, transportation, all that good stuff. What dads do. And like a lot of guys, that are the old territory, born and developed guys, a lot of these cats got paid every night back in the early days, every night in cash. And a lot of them saved nothing. I'm not saying Dusty didn't save a lot of money. I'm not saying that whatsoever because I don't know. But my thoughts are, if I had to bet, he was not unlike any of the other boys in that era that they made, spent what they made and sometimes a little bit more. So he simply did that gig because it was the best opportunity he had to make, you know, probably north of six figures and take care of his family. And that was the reason. It was there and he needed the cash to do what dads and husbands do.
Dusty would write, "So I was there doing these videos, like being a plumber, which in a way was a tribute to my dad, and being a meat cutter, which I thought was a cute skit. But the pizza delivery guy was done because Jim Herd over at WCW was hired from a pizza company, as I previously explained. So that was a rib on him. And up there, ribs like that were pretty common. And a lot of them were pointed at me. Ted DiBiase's black chauffeur, Mike Jones, who they call Virgil, was meant as a rib, but that backfired because that's how he got over." When did you guys talk about the Million Dollar Man's Ted DiBiase, you know, his bodyguard being named Virgil. Is that something that, I mean, everybody immediately caught on and you guys were having fun with on the other side of the fence? Because that character had been around even when Dusty was working with you.
Yeah. We kidding him about it. And I remember one time, Gary Hart goes on TV and he's building a matchup on TBS with somebody. It might've been Kabuki or it was like, but a heel with Dusty. And to Gary wanted to be, very realistic, very real life, reality based, matters. And he was great at creating them, by the way. Gary Hart is very underrated and cause a lot of people don't even know who the hell he is. But he's worth checking out because Gary Hart is one of the great managers of all time. And he didn't play the role. He was an evil man. And I say that, and I love Gary. Hey, I had a lot of fun with him. He taught me a lot, but one time he was doing a promo and, he called Dusty Virgil. He said, I remember like it's yesterday. He said at the end, his closing line was, "Remember, we're coming to get you, Virgil." So I thought it was a hell of an interview.
Right.
I didn't quite get the Virgil thing. I knew that was Dusty's real name, but I just didn't put it all together immediately. So the next time we do TV, he's given some direction to Teddy Long to take to the heels or something. And I remember him saying this again vividly, and tell Gary Hart not to call me Virgil. So he got it all. He got all that. He didn't like being made fun of. Look, let me tell you something. When you get a guy that's didn't have the matinee idol body, that didn't have his face is not going to be on, you know, America's Most Beautiful People thing, Most Sexiest Man in America, even though he may have thought he was, he wasn't. And he knew it. He also had that little list. You know, he'd have Bell's palsy just like me. And his Bell, that's why his smile is crooked. Look at early day Dusty Rhodes pictures. And then moving on through and when he was in Florida, he got Bell's palsy when he was wrestling for Eddie Graham in Florida. And never healed. That's why his little smile is crooked. So, but a lot of us guys, Connor, I'm not speaking for you because you got the confidence of a, you know, king. That's why you're the grand.
Oh,
you know,
my gosh. Listen to you.
You're the grand potentate, or what the fuck I called you. Anyhow, I'm going crazy here down the F word. I'm sorry, folks. I'll settle down. But we get self-conscious, especially when you're in the public eye. You can't imagine how many times it's been leaked back to me from upper management. Well, JR needs to lose weight. He's always going to sound like a hillbilly. Now he can't smile. God damn, what's he on the air for? Oh, I don't know. Maybe a storyteller. Who knows? Dusty was like that way. That's why I think he overcompensated as that sex symbol. He knew he wasn't a sex symbol, but if you tell somebody something on television long enough with enough conviction, they'll believe it. And so I think there's a little bit of that in his personality too. He just didn't have the looks, and he's cut his head, all scarred up. And, you know, he was a beautiful man because the beauty really comes from the inside out, but he felt self-conscious, Conrad, about his size, and the role. Hey, look, you're out there in a pair of shorts, for God's sakes.
Right.
He didn't even wear long tights. He didn't wear a top. So he was ballsy in that regard, but I can tell you, he had to have a lot of courage to wear regular tights and those cowboy style wrestling boots. And that's it. I admire him for that, but it still, I think, bothered him. It was always a concern. That's why you didn't hear guys too often go too far down the rabbit hole on calling him fat and out of shape and all that stuff. That was not a line that a heel would use very frequently with Dusty. He didn't let him.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Let's talk about, you know, what he did let happen, and that's polka dots. And it's been debated a lot. You know, Bruce Pritchard has denied for a long time that it wasn't a rib, that, you know, them putting him in polka dots wasn't a rib. And, you know, people have dug up who were trying to support that, that, hey, once upon a time, even when Dusty, or before he was in the WWF, he wore polka dots here and there. And polka dots were, I guess, sort of in fashion if you looked at the fashion magazines back in 1989, but Dusty always believed it was a rib. I mean, especially when you have the evidence of not only calling Mike Jones Virgil, but also too, you had the one man gang sort of shuck and jive a little bit, for lack of a better word, and call himself the African Dream as opposed to Dusty's American Dream, when even Meltzer was saying that Dusty was trying to, quote, talk black. Obviously those type of things are not the way people speak now, but the idea was Dusty was trying to make himself, saleable and have some appeal to African-American communities with his promos. And if they thought, well, we'll make fun of the way he dances in the ring too, and call Akeem the African Dream, both of those very clearly ribs on Dusty. What's your take on the polka dots? Was it a rib? You know, McMahon.
I think it was. Look, Bruce was there. I wasn't. And I know Bruce loved Dusty as much as I did. And a lot of the rest of us that, you know, were fans of his work, quite frankly, just big fans of his work. But I think there's a little evilness, a little mischievous vent on the Dusty characterization. Why? Again, who knows? It was much like, I never wore a cowboy hat, even when I was growing up in Oklahoma. Never. My dad wore one every day. I never wore one at all because I didn't want to be like him, like a defiant kid, unfortunately. But I never wore a cowboy hat, and we wore cowboy hats one time. I think it was at San Antonio Royal Rumble, Vince and Lawler and myself, and he liked it so much, he said, I'd like you to wear a hat every week. Now, I didn't like the hat, the hat became part of my signature. Now I'm glad we did it.
Right.
But you know, it's just Vince having his creative visions and feeling compelled to execute them no matter what, if they bother a town or not. So that's kind of where that was. I think it was a rib. I have a hard time being able to defend that it wasn't. And I think Dusty was a key player with the competition. And without calling out the competition, or like, without doing any billionaire Ted skits, as we saw later on, I think that it was a subtle way to throw a little shade on Dusty, because he was a top baby face, the booker, and the owner's right-hand man.
Dusty would write about his time in the WWF. I think one of the things that frustrated me the most at the WWF was they had writers trying to put words in my mouth, saying things I would never say. The first time there, Vince had me trying to read off a teleprompter. Here I was, one of the greatest interviews in our entire industry, and they were trying to put words in my mouth that I would never say. It took one of their writers 9 times trying to write and rewrite what they wanted me to say until Vince finally had them just bullet point what they wanted so I could say it my way. I'd noticed that when Hogan cut his promos, they gave him bullet points and he would never use a teleprompter to read. So why was there a different standard for Dusty Rhodes? You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, scripting and promos these days. And it's sort of a fun exercise to go back and look at, given the way wrestling is produced now in the WWE, would some of the talent that got over so big even have an opportunity if they had to sort of fit into that system? Dusty is very clearly saying that would not have worked for him.
Bad system. You gotta be smart enough as a businessman to change your system to fit the talents and their skill sets. If bullet points help a talent to do a killer promo that's entertaining, it's informative, it's just something really good that you enjoyed listening and watching, then that's what you should do. You can't have one system that's going to fit everybody's needs, because everybody's not the same. And for a long time, currently, like in WWE, as you brought up, you know, that's how it was. except for a few guys. And so then you find out if you, you know, if you want the old wrestling thing is a telephone, telegraph, telewrestler. So Dusty knew that Hogan was doing bullet points, and that's it. And so that was all he needed. He did it for Hogan, did it for me, because quite frankly, and Hogan was not a bad promo guy, but he wasn't no Dusty Rhodes. There were very few can say they were Dusty Rhodes. He was the best, as good a promo guy as I ever fucking heard, ever. Unique, great storyteller, had passion, had an interesting look, couldn't take your eyes off the screen. So he had appeal in another way. But yeah, I think that the pro wrestling system works best when talented men and women who have charisma and the skill to collect their thoughts into a 2 or 3 minute capsule that's entertaining. That's one of the things that makes the business so good. That's one of the things. I can't tell you how many fans I've talked to, Conrad, over my lifetime that said they started watching wrestling when they were young because they love the promos. They love to hear those guys talk and talk trash. And now talking trash is a art form in every pro sport there is. But all that started with wrestling because the talking trash was what heels did. So every show had to have a great heel. That's why I'm saying having a great heel is probably as important as having that one over baby face. If you can have one over baby face, you're lucky. You got to make that happen, no doubt. But boy, if you are not developing heels at the same time, and they can't get over, if they're not over, they can't get over working with each other. Over, not over versus not over. Guess is what? It's not over.
Well,
that's how that worked to me. And Dusty was so talented, such a fertile imagination. You know, he would have been a great poet. Dusty would have been a great novelist. He just had that. He could write down his visions, and maybe he needed his grammar corrected from time to time, or something like that, or did he? But he was so good at collecting his thoughts and then giving them to you.
The polka dots did, in fact, get over. And his biggest, most high-profile situation in the company is a feud with the Macho King, Randy Savage, and Sensational Sherry, and that leads to a mixed tag match on WrestleMania 6 in 1990 in Toronto. It's a pretty big deal to have Dusty Rhodes on a WrestleMania, and unfortunately, it's not going to make it very much longer. He won't survive to WrestleMania 7. Meltzer would write, after a year and a half, Rhodes was stunned when McMahon fired him a few months after having the debuting Undertaker destroy him heads up with no gimmicks at the 1990 Survivor Series in a way that nobody had seen Rhodes destroyed before in a heads up fair situation. It was one thing for Dusty Rhodes to be fired for a beef with management. He'd had those things happen before since he was doing things his way. And if the owner of the company got mad, he was the greatest sports attraction in the world, and there was no shortage of places for him to go. It was quite another to be fired when he was behaving and making the best out of a bad situation. But McMahon was always about youth and looks. Rhodes was old and really heavy, and there was no more fun in humiliating him. And he'd already had him put people over everywhere, which he knew, but Rhodes didn't, was on the way out. When you see the squash happen at Survivor Series, cause even though you weren't there, I'm sure you guys were watching the competition's pay-per-view. And when you see the Undertaker run through him at his debut at Survivor Series 90, did that catch you off guard? Because that isn't something that we normally saw from Dusty, especially in high profile situations.
Well, you look at that in one of two ways. You look at it in the way we're discussing here, where Dusty, didn't get hardly anything in the match. It was just basically a glorified squash match, as was said. But it's also evidence that McMahon had made a definitive commitment to build the in-ring persona of the Undertaker. And so somebody's got to be sacrificed. And then some people's vision of that is to have a quick squash match. And I don't know that, that's sort of the best way of doing that, but it's a way, no doubt there's a way, but with somebody that's superstar status like Dusty that had been a NWA champion, which didn't do me any favors in WWE whatsoever. he got guzzled. And I never thought that was the way to do it. And I can tell you what, I believe you asked Mark Calloway, he'd probably agree with me. They could have had a match to where Dusty, here's the thing. If Dusty had a flash of brilliance and he had a comeback, he did something where he just wouldn't die. He just kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And God almighty, this guy's just got a heart. Well, then when Undertaker beats him, it means so much more because you saw brilliance. You saw competitiveness. You saw toughness before the guy goes down for the three count. But if you just go from beat up, three count, who'd you really help? So basically, I'm not saying it's about Dusty, but in this case, if that happens, you lessen your victory. So I think that was another thing that was a little retaliatory, because there's a better way of doing it that I think I just explained than just going in and walking through somebody. I was a little shocked, quite frankly. But I came out of this deal. Man, McMahon loves The Undertaker. And I had a vested interest in that, too, because I was one of the guys who encouraged Undertaker to leave WCW and go to WWE because Ole wasn't going to use him.
One of the things that Dusty wrote in his book about going back to WCW was when I went back to WCW as their booker, which back then it wasn't quite the full blown executive producer role just yet. At first it was really cool, but it wasn't long before the politics of the business started in again. And Bischoff would write about Dusty in his book saying Dusty followed Ole as booker and it was a much better situation, but we still couldn't get the right feel to our stories. Dusty could be pretty progressive, but like most other wrestlers, he thought just one week or maybe 1 month at a time. Bookers generally weren't used to building story arcs and understanding character development ahead of time. This had become important because we were now shooting 13 weeks of shows at a time. And if you didn't think ahead, you were sunk. So I brought in two Hollywood writers I met in Disney MGM Studios and forced Dusty to work with them. I didn't want them to drive the storytelling. I wanted them to take Dusty's vision and help formulate a structure or a Bible that would give us a plan to work from. Dusty would say, okay, this is where these guys are going to end up, and here's the personal issue between them. And the writers would go back and add detail, put in dialogue, and create a long-term structure. Dusty is one of the most imaginative, creative people I've ever met, but he was used to going from week to week. He had a tremendous understanding of all the little nuances of wrestling storylines. I just couldn't get him to wrap his head around what I really wanted and buy into it. Do you remember Dusty's return, and was it all just high fives and, hey, the gang's back together again? And how long does that last before it feels like, oh shit, the honeymoon's over?
No, I thought the honeymoon was over when he got there, and not because of him. The longer this somewhat incestuous group of people all looking to attain power, all buying into the pro wrestler edict of, don't trust Steve Austin's thing. Don't trust anybody. The politics are hideous. And that was one of the things that always appealed to a lot of guys about going to work for Vince. Vince was the boss. You didn't have to worry. You didn't get a different answer from this guy. You didn't get a different answer from Hurd or another answer from Mr. Barnett or another answer from the booker, who that was at that point in time. It's just so fragmented. So I didn't think it was a great place to work. And I also thought that Hurd's idea at the time to have a booking committee was ill-fated and ill-conceived. There were a lot of very, very talented people on the booking committee that left of their own devices could have been great at booking, writing. The booker primarily is writing a TV show. And then after the TV show is successful, whatever, then you take that content that you created on the television, you take it to the live events, house shows back in the day. So I just thought the booking committee was very, very restrictive for him. Was it a bad thing to have a booking committee? I don't think it was good for Dusty because he wasn't comfortable and he wasn't in his element. But I also understand that, the collection of talents that are on that booking committee, if we had more structure, it would all been smarter. We would have had a better line of communication. One of the reasons that guys used to get pissed at me, they'd say they were pissed. They just said to me, they could have, and I just explained to them. about my relationship with Jim Herd. When the booking committee dispersed Conrad for the day, or maybe for the week, because it was hard to get everybody to come in and be on the committee over 1 or 2 days a week, if that. So my point is, they were not in the office much more than they were. So then Herd, who's trying to learn the business and he's trying to figure this stuff out, he's batching. Well, he's in Atlanta. His wife's in St. Louis. I wasn't married at the time. I was between gigs, as they say. And so a lot of nights he say, you want to go have a steak on Ted? Well, yeah, I'm going to go home and look what's in the fridge or carry out or something. Hell yeah, we'll go to one of those great steakhouses like Bones or some of those good ones in Atlanta. And Ted bought dinner and the booze. So I remember Herb was a gin guy. He'd say, God damn, it takes a lot of gin to run this engine. So I would try to match him with the Crown Royal. Same thing I told Brett Favre one time in 1992. No matter how hard we try, we're not going to drink all the Crown Royal in Atlanta. And we didn't. But that's my old deal with Herd. All the guys would leave. And then we'd discuss this or that. And, you know, I tried to defend our position as a booking committee and so forth and so on. But if he got with somebody that didn't like something and it put a and put a burr under his saddle, he'd arbitrarily change shit or add stuff. And then guys would think, well, JR did that. No, he didn't. They didn't know. So I was just the only member of the committee that stayed there, seemingly, and that had the time to go out and babysit Herd. It's that kind of how it worked out. And look, we argue like cats and dogs, man. Oh, yeah, I've been called an SOB and an MFR and all this other stuff I heard. Mad, angry, because I didn't agree with his deal. Or he would say, how do you know it won't work? I said, because I've seen it try before, Jim. It doesn't work. Oh, my God. But his obsession was to follow. He wanted the success of the WWE, WWF at the time, obviously. And so he tried to out-Vince Vince. And I said, man, you're not even the same zip code. This is never going to work with that theory.
Let me tell you what Dusty wrote about Jim Herd. Herd, a marketing guy or something like that, who came from Pizza Hut, who was the blooming idiot of corporate America. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to bury people who I feel have done me wrong or who I may not like personally, but this guy was never really in the wrestling business, so he is fair game. That said, he was the most untalented motherfucker in the history of the world. Whether you were running pizza, whether you were running a road race, or whether you were running to the fucking bathroom, he had the least talent of any human being I had ever been around in my entire life. He had no gamesmanship and no skills at all as far as employees went. And I say that a lot, but I liked him outside of the business when he wasn't drinking with Jim Ross after each day was over, where they would have cocktails and Jim was pointing him on the floor because he knew how to play Herd like a fiddle. And he would continue, we know Jim's pretty smart. And to this day, JR is a cool guy. He just wanted my job. And what's wrong with that? He made no bones about it. And I respected him for that. So there's a little bit of a shot across the bow from Dusty's book where he believes you wanted his booker position. And that's the reason you were sort of cuddled up with Herd.
Sure.
Your response?
He makes a good point. You know, I was a Herd's guy because again, I was the only guy there. He wanted to go out and talk. What'd you guys talk about in the meeting? There was such lousy communication coming out of the booking committee because the hodgepodge group of very intelligent guys that all believe they should have Dusty's job, you know, and they may deny it to this day. But I doubt it. If you got to be asking for an honest answer, I did not want Dusty's job. I wanted the job. I wanted Herd's job. That's what I wanted. And I didn't want to be the booker. I didn't want to be a babysitter. I didn't want to be second guess every turn in the road. And that's what bookers get. And anytime you have active performers on the decision-making group, it inherently is going to lead to some challenges that you have to address because it's inevitable. It's going to happen. Talents don't trust other talents who have power. Dusty's smartest thing Dusty did there in that era, somewhere in that neighborhood, was to stop working, stop wrestling. And it got a little better, but he was bored with it. I can tell you that. But no, I never wanted Dusty's job, but I can understand why he thought that. And I can understand the misperception of my relationship with Herd. I mean, if they had been, look, I'm Native American. I'm a Cherokee Indian. Very proud of it. And but the one thing about us Cherokees, it may go for other Native American tribes, we don't hold our fire water real well. And so I get past the point of no return here, and I can get rather loud and obnoxious. And so Herd was same deal. He was loud and obnoxious, but he was the boss. So he didn't like to be challenged. I was always had this propensity that you want, don't ask me my opinion if you don't want it. I'm happy to talk about St. Louis Cardinal baseball. I don't give a shit if we're talking about wrestling tonight. You're the one who brought it up. You want my honest opinion? I'm giving it to you. And then he would disagree with my opinion. So I said, I don't have a right to give my opinion. Yes, ask for my opinion, for God damn it. What do you want? Well, I want some more gin, God damn it. There's a lot of gin on this engine. It's not the same old deal. So there was a misconception there. But, you know, I did not want to be the booker. I wanted to be the man above the booker and get this shit organized and help be his editor. You know, I think he needed somebody there that he trusted and that he could bounce things off of, be a filter, so to speak. But, it just never worked out. But that's the story there. I did not want Dusty's job. I saw some great things he did booking wise. He has some very, you know, the thing with he and when Magnum TA was probably arguably the hottest baby face in America. And maybe only behind Hogan.
Right.
But in time, because Mag was such more athletic, had great charisma, amazing look. I used to kid him about this, and you're going to get over so much here, and then you're going to leave and go to take Hogan's spot in WWF. He'd laugh. But he liked NWA, and he loved Dusty. Dusty got him from Cowboy. We brought him out here from Florida, out here at Oklahoma, and, you know, he became a huge star. And we did some great angles with him. You know, that someday we'll talk about the angle where he had to take the 10 lashes from the Midnight Express, and his partner, Mr. Wrestling 2, walked out before he could take his lashes. So Magnum had to take them all. Great angle. It's so great if you're doing it in every town for about a week because your back starts looking like chopped liver, all bad, scarred up and red and bruised. So, but Magnum was, when Magnum got hurt in that damn car accident, the fact that he made the superpowers with Nikita Koloff, who was a red hot heel. I mean, red hot, not simmering, not he's there. He was red hot. Make him a baby face, a Russian baby face with a white guy that sounds like Muhammad Ali, which is what he wanted to sound like, was ingenious because it worked. It worked. So he did some great booking stuff. He did some creating all those major events. He, as good as anybody I've ever seen, could create a big event, you know, whether it be Starrcade or Great American Bash or whatever. And those tours he did were printing money for one summer there with Crockett. But they, you know, so it was, he was a very good booker, but he started depending too much on himself and he didn't have fresh heels to work with.
What do you think of the assessment though, where he says, you know, he wanted my job. He made no bones about it. I mean, did you guys have a conversation where, you know, when does he ever try to confront you and call you out about, look at you over there kissing Jim Herd's ass. And then you say something like, I'm just making sure my job's safe. You should do the same or something like that. Yeah.
He would rib me about Herd. Where'd you and Herd go to eat last night?
Right.
And you know, I'd always embellish it. Oh, I had a bigger steak, man. Having some Crown Royal, had a great time. And her and Ted picked up the tab, which is, you know, kind of, I'm bullshitting him back.
Sure.
But I don't think he ever discussed it with me in a mean spirited way. It was almost like laughing because we knew what we had to deal with there. You know, it's better to be, it's like Vince told Hunter one time trying to hire me back. He said, I'd rather JR be, inside the tent pissing out as outside the tent pissing in. Really, that's a good negotiating leverage. So I say with tongue in cheek. So no, we never had any words, but you know, I don't think he ever quite understood that. You know, Herd was not, I knew Herd was not going to last forever, or even close to forever. And who's next? So that's kind of where I wanted. But no, we didn't have any arguments about that whatsoever. I can just be honest with you. I never wanted his job. I wanted Herd's job. And that's what basically motivated me to leave WWE in 93 when Eric got hired after going through several other people. So that's kind of where that went.
Talk to me a little bit about when he makes the transition, not from you into his job, but him into your job. He all of a sudden becomes a commentator and you guys wound up working some shows together. Whose idea was that? How does it come together? And how did you enjoy working with him that way?
Well, that was his idea. And I enjoyed it. We always had good chemistry. We had good timing. We thought so much alike in our basic philosophy of pro wrestling that heels have to be disliked. They can't have too many redeeming social qualities. They have to be certainly willing to cheat to win at any time. They'll do anything to gain an unfair advantage. And then there were rules. And I understand it may be ambiguous to say or even ludicrous to say that there are rules in pro wrestling. But there were rules in pro wrestling. And when you were proficient at breaking the rules, because you only had to hide breaking the rules from one person, the referee, you did it where everybody else could see it. What's helped you with your animosity and your heel angst? So now there's very few rules to break. Clinch fists are legal, you know, and that's a decision made by the influence of the talent, because some of it are basically lazy. And a lot of times they're creating something new, but, Dusty and I got along well in that regard. And then he became my color analyst on TBS. We worked several shows together. We worked some pay-per-views together. I remember they made him a big old, I wonder what happened to you. They got him a big red leather jacket. I saw a picture, our graphic this week. There'll be a picture of several pictures of Dusty and I together at different places. And you'll see one in there. He's wearing a red leather jacket that Turner had made for him.
It was a go-to. He wore it all the time.
Yeah, and I used to love it because I said, it's so nice that you thought of me having this jacket made to make it the Oklahoma colors, as opposed to the goddamn putrid burnt orange. And you know, he just hated it. They ain't got nothing to do with the damn thing. It does to me. So, he was just a classic guy and we had fun. You know, we never had a production meeting for us, that lasted 10 minutes, much like Jerry Lawler and I, you know, he found out early on Lawler didn't like to prep. He wanted to go with his instincts, which worked for him brilliantly. And Dusty's largely the same way. So he fed off me. And he told me he was going to do that. Because I had years of experience. That's what I did. And whether I was good at it or not, at least I had more reps at it than Dusty had sitting in that position. So he was a great listener. Sometimes I tell people, young guys, ask me, what do I got to do to be a good broadcaster? Well, if you're going to work in a 2 or 3 man booth, you got to be a great listener. So you can connect all the dots and keep all the dots connected. And he was great at that, man. And just look, he was booking the shows. He knew where he wanted to go. It's like when I work events, he knew where he wanted to go and it made it easier. So, I had fun with him. We had a lot of fun. Of course, in today's world, we'd be way too fat, way too Southern. Can you imagine? We had two guys out there that were one from Texas, one from Oklahoma, you know, nice chubby boys. And we're on national television, which goes to prove that wrestling fans do not watch wrestling to see how pretty the announcers are. I know it sounds biased coming from me. I get that too. So I apologize for that, folks. But quite frankly, you guys don't watch wrestling because you want to see what the announcers are wearing or how pretty they are or whatever. Are you kidding me?
Well, nobody knew that more than Dusty. He says, I don't think any announcer stands up to him. He used to say Gordon was the best and he was the king, but JR is the best man to get. If I was going to get someone to call a world's title match and everybody was equal age wise at the same time, Ross would be my chosen guy to go to war with. So he had a ton of respect for you and he had, I guess we should say a rather unconventional approach to commentary. How difficult was that for you to get used to, or do you guys just peas in a pod right away because of your real life relationship?
I think we had organic and natural timing, Conrad, because you know, we had a long standing relationship. I'll tell you a story. The not long after Crockett purchased the UWF from Cowboy, we had a television taping, and I believe the one I'm thinking about was in Muskogee, Oklahoma, believe it or not, Muskogee Civic Center. I'd refereed a ton of basketball games in that building over the years. So we're back there to do wrestling. And we had this tournament, I believe it was a tournament, and we had the finals there. And it was, I don't know if it was Bub, I'll get all these guys mixed up on time because it's been so damn long ago. It was either Big Bubba Rogers, AKA, you know, Ray Trader, AKA the Big Boss Man, One Man Gang, or maybe Terry Gordy, and maybe Doc. All those guys are involved in the final, getting to the, as I remember, getting to the finals. Anyway, whoever's in the finals, you guys, somebody probably knows off the top of their head. But it was an amazing match between super heavyweights. And I had a good night. And Dusty got the tape back, and he was beside himself. So before he called me. And he called me, and he said, I can't thank you enough what you did. He said, you put on a goddamn clinic. And I'm going to make David, speaking of David Crockett, David and Tony come into the office and listen to it. This is how you get talent over. This is how you call a big time, big field title match. And I'm thinking, oh, that's pretty cool. And I thanked him, and I'll see you TV, blah, blah, blah. Then I hang up and I'm thinking, well, I think Dusty just inadvertently alienated David and Tony from me. Because the last thing you're going to want to do is see me. And after you had to come to the office and listen to that show and that match in particular. I don't know that it affected Tony that much because Tony lets pretty much everything roll off his back. That's why he probably lived to be 130. But David was never overly pleased with me. We've since had, you know, we're fine, but it wasn't a great way to be introduced. I just got on, hey, I just a new kid on campus. So, but that was how Dusty believed. Sports oriented, dramatic, a lot of good drama, be real, be organic, everything you'd want. That's what he wanted. So I was lucky that Dusty was, more than willing to, have patience with me and teach me what he wanted and some other things. Conrad, I would never have been on TBS in the level that I achieved if it hadn't been for Dusty Rhodes, because Class of Champions number one in Greensboro was Tony Schiavone and me, and Tony was the lead guy on TBS and play-by-play guy. And I was, I was doing UWF at the time, and I might have been, I can't remember the times, but I was a play-by-play guy. So we had the same role, did the same job. And he said, I want you to work with Tony. Can you work with Tony? I said, of course I can. So I shoot the breeze with Tony, and Tony said, cool. We liked each other. We traveled together some. So getting on there in a role as a color analyst on a live with no net, a primetime national broadcast was a challenge. But he knew I could do it, and he knew what else he was doing. He was helping me get over with the TBS brass because I was going to play an important role in a show that everybody in the company was going to be watching. So I owe him a lot of my television career too, just because he believed in me and I always believed in him. So that was part of our charm of our relationship. But again, like I mentioned earlier, it wasn't always about wrestling. It was about a lot of stuff.
Of course he talks about in his book, the different management and, you know, the different individuals, whether it's Kip Fry or Jack Petrick or whoever. But one of the things he talks about is that when they changed the cornerstone of wrestling on TBS, the 605 show, it became WCW Saturday Night. So it was more of a talk show format with you interviewing people. And he says that he hated it and you hated it and you guys had to suck it up. And not too long after that, you're out of there. And of course, Dusty's going to be with WCW for the most part until 2001. There is a break in there somewhere. I know he popped up in ECW at Tabernacle taping in Atlanta and started a bit of a feud with the King of Old School, Steve Corino. And it's the first time we really saw him back in the ring, but he did something that a lot of people didn't see coming. And he joined the NWO in 1998. So none of this is happening when you're there, but he's still very much a staple in professional wrestling for either WCW or ECW. And after ECW and WCW close, he winds up starting his own promotion for a little bit, Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling. He also worked with TNA, I think from like 2003 to 2005. And then finally, he winds up back with the WWE, I think sometime in 2005, and he would remain there until he passed away. I think his last appearance on WWE programming is March 28th. He's there for the Hall of Fame, doing the little red carpet show. He himself, of course, went in the Hall of Fame in 2007. And
same year I did. I remember the discussion there was Vince was talking about that. He and I were talking about it with other guys, I'm sure. The order of induction, right? So I told Vince, I said, well, I don't care when I go on, but you got to close with Dusty because nobody can follow me. And I sure as shit don't want to follow him. And not that I should or even be considered for that role. Dusty should close the show unequivocally. And even though I had Stone Cold Steve Austin induct me, and we were on first, which also speaks to my theory of that on events like that, you want to get a good start. And the one thing I knew is that Stone Cold would give me a good start because when fans heard that glass break in that Fox Theater there in Detroit, they came out of their clothes, so to speak. They went nuts. So, and then I had to follow. Then I really did a good job of strategizing, Conrad. Then I only had to follow Stone Cold. Good luck. Anybody follow that song, huh? So, Dusty was, and I, 2007, yeah, that was a special time. I can remember seeing Jan smiling, and that's always been a great memory for me. I can see a smile on her face. She was so proud. And she knew everybody. She loved Dusty, too. I can't remember. I think he called her Sugar Pie, something like that. Always hugged her. Of course, you know, he was a sex symbol. He's going to hug all the women. But she loved him, and he was such a sweet man in that regard.
He was a four-time world champion. Of course, one of those wins is as the Midnight Rider in 83 against Ric Flair. And, of course, he had to vacate that when he refused to remove the mask. But he would beat Flair in St. Louis in 86 when Crockett was super hot, but he wound up beating Harley Race for his first and his second title runs in 79 and 81. And when you think about those names, you know, Ric Flair, Harley Race, Dusty Rhodes, just classics, and they're all legends. And you guys worked together on the Legends of Wrestling series. This predates the network. You guys had a format with the WWE for the on-demand service, and it was called 24/7, and you guys produced several of these, and it seems like Dusty and Jim Ross were staples on those. Any fun memories from filming those? Because I think a lot of fans find them on the network now and still love them, even though they're, gosh, more than 10 years old now.
Well, we did a couple of things there. All of us, a lot of the guys on those panels love to smoke cigars. And the one thing we knew is that if we could convince Kevin Dunn, the executive producer, that we'd like the ability to smoke a cigar during the show. There was an old show back in the day where these, I think it was maybe based out of Chicago. There was these sports writers and they sat on this table and you could see the smoke in the room. They're smoking their stogies and talking sports and a little bar atmosphere. So I can tell you this. We had, if you see cups on the table, you go back and look at that show on the network, they all have booze in them. Everybody on the show was drinking. As best I recall, it may have been one or two guys who were teetotalers, but you don't find that too much in wrestling. And they were smoking cigars. And the reason we smoked the cigars was we knew that Vince was not going to slip in and stay long if he smelled cigar smoke. He's out. He can't stand it. I said, the only thing else we can do is just all of us start coughing if we see him. I'll cough his ass out of the room. He'll leave. But seriously, it was basically the cigars were kind of leave us alone here. And man, we had so much fun. We laugh at each other. We'd tell stories. This guy's story would lead to that guy's story. This guy's story wouldn't jive with this guy's story. It was a blast, man. Cause we all were able to produce ourselves to some degree. None of us had a script. No cards, no prompters. It was just absolutely great. And he was as good as anybody telling those damn stories. I mean, he was just, he had great recall. And what he didn't recall, he'd make up. It's like, that's why I do some commentary with him. He'd say, he'd give a word. And I said, then I'd ever go to commercial break. I said, what the hell that word mean? I don't know. I just made it up. I told you, it's one time he said, I've checked my repetenda. So I said to the commercial, Dusty, what the fuck does repetenda mean? Sooner you'll understand someday when you have to know the dream. I said, Dusty, we're at a commercial break. Just me and you now. He said, I don't know what the hell it means. It's a word. Okay. Repetenda. So you guys want to use repetenda? Maybe that's a t-shirt, Conrad. I don't know. What's your repetenda?
I like it.
If you will.
Unfortunately, you had to write a blog back around June 11th, 2015. And that's the reason we're covering this. We realized last week as we were talking that we had just passed the anniversary of his passing. And you wrote a blog about talking to him just a week prior to his passing. And during that conversation, he was trying to convince you that he was just fine. But you contend that you knew something was wrong when you saw him in San Jose at WrestleMania, because he had had significant weight loss. And you sort of compare him to John Wayne. And I know off air, you've told me he was wrestling as John Wayne, at least to you. And he would always insist that he was fine and he didn't want any empathy or sympathy or anything like that. What do you remember about that bad phone call you had to take when you learned that your friend was no longer with us?
Well, I was in Asheville, North Carolina, doing some charity work for, Evelyn Charities. And I'm national chairman of a group called Headlock on Hunger. And, we collect food in that area to feed kids. They find out that in America that 25% of the kids don't eat regularly if they're not in a, school program. So in other words, if they're in the summertime, no school, or it's holidays, no school, a lot of kids do not eat regularly. And it's a abhorrent to think that that's in our country or anybody's country. Nothing else matters when you're hungry, as the saying goes. So I'm there doing some work. And, I noticed that my, phone was just going crazy. I was recording an interview for a WWE DVD, cause I was there and they wanted to get it in a can. So I said, well, I'll be here on this date. You can do it there if you want to. So then I finally took a bathroom break and I went in to see my phone and I got messages off the kazoo. So I called the office. What's going on? They said, well, Dusty passed away. So, oh God, I just couldn't believe it. It just humbled me so much. I just felt so distraught and heartbroken to lose a friend like that. And a guy that he has so much, we had so much in common. We weren't pretty guys. We are common. You know, I used to, the one of the nicest things I did for him that I didn't realize I was being that nice when I did it. And some of the fans remember, I used to talk about and give a shout out to Dusty's mama. Down in Austin, she lived in Austin, big wrestling fan. You know, she liked wrestling when Dusty was a kid. So Dusty's on the side of Dusty's mama today. She's doing good, whatever. And she loved it. And her friends loved it. And boy, Dusty just, he said, soon I can't thank you enough for shouting out to my mama. So I met her. I loved the lady. And she looked at him and looked like she looked a lot alike, by the way, in the face, young Dusty and mama Rhodes. So, you know, I just didn't, it's one of those situations you find yourself in, Conrad, much like when Jan got killed. I didn't know really what to do. I didn't know how to react. There's, you know, you can go to all the Barnes and Noble or Amazon you want. You're not going to find too many books that can lead you through grieving. And I'm sure there's been a zillion of them written. I didn't want to read about it. I had to get through this. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. And I had to go back out and be creative and do this video and, you know, try to make a few calls and just get a hold of Michelle and his wife, Michelle. And, you know, it shattered me. It just shattered me. Because I'd been in communication with him. And when we went to San Jose, I was sitting behind him at ringside, on the Hall of Fame. And I noticed he had to go to the bathroom a lot and he's very unstable. So I would always get up when he got up and we'd walk together to the bathroom. And he kind of leaned on me and, you know, I was there. It wasn't real obvious because he didn't want that, for God's sakes. But I knew something was really wrong. You can't lose that much weight. Conrad, Dusty wore a 7.5 hat, size 7.5 cowboy hat. And I bet you that when he started getting sick and his body was just forsaking him, I bet his hat size dropped to maybe 7 1/4. He lost weight everywhere. And he looked, his eyes got sunk back in his head. You just knew that something wasn't right. And you just, then the other shoe was going to drop. How long will we have him under the circumstance? But God almighty, I didn't expect a week. You know, and look, if I had known that Dusty was in that, feeling that bad, if he had just been honest, then I'd have gone to Florida and hung out with him. Why wouldn't I? You know, I could see sitting down and, hey, Dream, I know you're feeling good. Let's go write a book together. I'll come to Florida and spend a week. Or something like that. He'd have done it. Let's have some fun with it. Tell stories and laugh. But I didn't have a clue. So it hit me, not totally blindsided me, but it hit me hard enough that I didn't want to continue the day. And, you know, the other thing about Dusty and myself is Dusty's birthday, if I'm not mistaken, is October the 11th. Jan and I got married on October the 12th. And the OU Texas game, or in respect to the Dream today, the Texas OU game is played on the second Saturday in October, which is around that 10th or 11th, 12th date as a rule. So that time of the year was a big deal for us, his birthday. And I think I wrote in that vlog that, you know, on his birthday, I would oftentimes get up and go to give him a phone call before Jan got out of bed and wish him happy birthday, shoot the shit, have some fun. And, before I even talked to her about our anniversary. So that whole period of time, every October is a big deal to me. It's a big deal to me that when I tell you and I talk about doing some tours and doing some things, you know, I really want to be back to be where I can watch the OU Texas game. It's a special game for me because of personal issues, not just because of the football rivalry. You know, it's like if you had been to every Auburn, Alabama, every Iron Bowl for the last 30 years, you'd probably want to continue going to the Iron Bowl. It's your deal.
You teased us last week with a story about playing horse at Jim Crockett Jr.'s house, for money with Dusty. What can you tell us about that?
Well, he beat my ass, pretty convincingly, cost me $100. We were going to dinner. Crockett was putting his crew together after the buyout, and he saw that I could help him in more areas than just as a broadcaster, even though I was perfectly content to do only that one role. So we're at a nice restaurant in Charlotte, I want to believe that it was a French restaurant. Why? I don't know. But I know there was a lot of escargot being consumed and booze, lots of it. So, I'm staying at Jimmy's house, as I recall. And, I stayed there with his wife at the time, his daughters. And, he had a basketball goal there. So all night we've been back and forth this OU Texas rivalry. And he was talking about, you know, I don't know how we got on the subject of this, but we got a subject of, well, I could beat your ass shooting a basketball, Dusty. God almighty. You think I can't play basketball? And he said, well, you don't think I can play basketball, do you? I said, I wouldn't say you'd probably be a great basketball player, fat bastard. I'm a fat bastard. We're not either one of these basketball. We're white and slow and fat. How can we be great basketball players? He said, well, I'm just a good shooter. One thing led to another. Then the challenge went down to play a game of horse. The game of horse started at 2 a.m. And we were both drunk at Hooter Brown. Or some parts of the country, Cooter Brown.
Yeah, it's Cooter Brown down here in Alabama.
All right, there you go. I'll go Cooter with you. All right, so we decided to play a game of horse for $100. And, it was a runaway. I got pasted. He might've had a H, but he beat my ass like a government mule without a doubt. And of course I never heard the last of that. That story with he and I lasted for ever. So from that point forward. So that was such a fun night, because here's the thing, man. The shit we were talking, the trash talking between shots was absolutely hilarious. In today's world, that would have been a great piece of video, but there's no record of it other than all event that he beat me like a dog, the old proverbial government mule, and give me a restaurant quality ass whipping. And I paid him $100 on the spot and did leave me a lot in my wallet. I can tell you that on that night, but nonetheless, he beat me fair and square. And by the way, Dusty was a very good shooter of basketball. You know, he really was. But the thing a lot of folks don't know, Dusty played a semi-pro football. Dusty told me, he said, I go to college at a school long enough to me, it was the fall semester or the winter or the spring semester. And I would go to where I could be eligible for that semester and play ball on that team that played. In other words, he might go to one school and play in the spring and play baseball. And he was a really good baseball player, really good baseball player. And then he would not go to class, of course, he'd be ineligible for that baseball team. So he transferred to another school. And back in the day, those old Texas junior colleges or some of those small colleges, you know, all you had to do is have a pulse and you're going to be eligible at least one semester. And so that was his MO. But he was one of those West Texas guys. And, you know, the Funks had such an influence on Dream, especially, Dory Sr. And of course Dory Jr. and his good buddy Terry Funk. Those two son of bitches made great music together. They were awesome. Some of that footage from Florida when Dusty was a baby face and Terry was a heel was absolutely classic. And Conrad, as you astutely mentioned earlier, if folks go back and listen to those promos, and they're available on YouTube and so forth, probably www.com remember, they weren't scripted. They weren't written by a writer. They were created in the minds of the talent that was delivering those lines. So the talents cast themselves in the role of the speaker. They were their own story writer, their own copywriter. It was a thing of beauty because it was real, it was natural, it was organic. And fans, even though they knew, quote unquote, it was still showbiz, they get lost in the presentation. And I find myself these days not getting lost in the presentation very much. The interview that Cody made after beating his brother at Double or Nothing was as close to this amazing magic that I've heard in years and years. And under the Stone Cold, he interviewed Tony Khan for his show, his podcast. And he said the same thing, essentially, that he can't remember when he was so emotionally invested. And that means probably, whether he'd admit it or not, he has some tears in his eyes. I did. I cried at the announce position during that promo. Now, does that make me an old fool? I guess it could. That's your perspective. But it makes me a fan that loved what he heard, and it meant something to him. And that was the whole deal about Dusty's promos. He had a way of making those promos relatable and to mean something to the individual hearing them. And that is a lost art.
You know, the most famous of which, you know, when you talk about Dusty Rhodes promos, everybody goes back to Hard Times. Let's take that one off the table. What's your favorite Dusty Rhodes promo? If you had sort of recommend everybody go back and watch this one promo, what would it be?
The promos leading into the Charlotte Great American Bash were all those bash promos that one summer. There was a summer of big outdoor shows, big shows that Dusty booked. And the promos for those towns, if you can find them, if you do look, you're smart. You guys are smarter than me on the IT stuff, but go back and look at those promos. And if you can find them, when they played Philly, for example, or they played Baltimore, find the promos he did for those towns that the nation would not have heard, but the local market did. And you're going to find some of the most amazing content you've ever heard. That summer was loaded with great promos from the Dream, because he was involved in personal issues against villains that had steam, that were over. And you were paying money to see Dusty whip the heel's ass. And I wonder if that happens that often in today's world.
The promos that he would have been doing in 1987 on the way to Charlotte for the Great American Bash would be with his feud with Tully Blanchard in a lights out barbed wire ladder match for $100,000. And in 85, he would have also been feuding with Tully Blanchard, but for the television title. I'm going to assume you're referencing either 85 or 87, because in 86, he was a part of, in Charlotte anyway, a part of a tag match. It was Dusty, Magnum, and Baby Doll taking on the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette. So probably 85 or 87.
Yeah. And he made great promos. You're probably right. He made great promos too. Double-edged sword here. He made great promos when, promoting a match involving, Cornette's Midnight Express. And what made him so effective was the fact that he was usually, responding to a Cornette interview about the same match. And between the two of them, you just got the feeling that you're seeing there's something special coming that I need to be a part of somehow. I'm a wrestling fan, and things like this may not be replicated anytime soon again. So that whole era right there was really good. I can tell you, Crockett getting Cornette, or having Cornette there, and then from us in the UWF thing, they fumbled on Dr. Death. But the guy that they had their eye on, that Dusty had his eye on, particularly, was the Sting, because he saw that Sting could be, you know, the next big thing, babyface, and so he had an emotional investment in things. He always made sure the villains had some juice, not steroids or blood, but you know, had some steam, and he was an artist, man. And I love this deal. I have been in those interview days. He would sit and listen to the other promos because that was his job. If somebody said something, bad date, bad opponent, whatever, or a line that was not going to get through, like Cornette saying, "She's got the nicest teeth I ever come across."
My God.
Yeah. Well, obviously a double entendre, but that didn't make air. But here it became a very competitive environment. There were a lot of guys there. This guy named Ric Flair was a pretty good promo guy, I heard, facetiously said. But by the time Dusty did his promos, he was in a competitive environment, and he was fucking ready to show these guys that the Bull of the Woods on the mic is still Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream.
I loved his feud with Rick. They were talking about the Omni, and Rick comes out and says, "I don't do no jobs in front of 70,000 people, just right on TBS. And so like a half hour later, it's Dusty's turn. And he sort of says something like, "Well, I ain't putting my shoulders on the mat. So what do we have?" And it was just something, their going back and forth was fun. And I liked the old one when he said, so I think he's talking to Kabuki, like, are you an assassin or an errand boy? There's so many of those famous little.
I got to just remember a great story. We're in Raleigh at the Dorton Arena, and the Dorton Arena was not air conditioned. And it was the big arena at that time in Raleigh, North Carolina, of course, which is just up the road from Mayberry. No kidding. But anyway, Raleigh was the site, and it was a summertime event. We're doing TV. It's hotter than eight acres of hell in that building. And one of the dressing rooms, which just happened to be the one that Dream used, because he had his monitors in there and he could watch the shows, and it was air conditioned. It was frigid air. It was really cool. So, Mr. Barnett was, there, and he was miserable because it's so hot and uncomfortable. And I said, "Well, let me take you to Dusty's place and you can hang out there. It's air conditioned." So we walk in. I remember walking down these little stairs into this very basic locker room, cool as hell, but so nice. And there he was, Dusty. He's laying on the floor, the concrete floor, which is pretty cool. And he had nothing on but his Austin Hall cowboy boots. That's the dressing boots, made by a company called Austin Hall, somewhere in Texas, I believe. And he's sitting there naked. So, the Dream and the Little Dream are all in full display. No shirt, no wristbands, no nothing. Nada. And he's down there and he's doing his Marlon Brando. "Are you an assassin or an errand boy? I said, are you a assassin or an errand boy? Barnett has got caught up, and he just now saw the whole display. And he says he had to get out of there. I said, I can't be here. And I said, Mr. Barnett, what's wrong? He said, if I saw much more of that, I might change teams. So that was the dream. But that was him. He was uninhibited, you know, even though you knew he had his, his insecurities, as a lot of us overweight guys do, and the Bell's palsy thing and the Southern accents and all that shit. To be a performer on television, you know, it's not mass appeal. You're told it's not mass appeal. And I never believed that, but nonetheless, he and I both battled for our spots against some odds of typical television programming and casting. So he was funny. Barnett, he had to get out of there. Did you know he was going to be done? Is this a rib? No, I didn't have any idea. We didn't set this up, Mr. Barnett. I didn't know what, you never know what Dream's going to do. I know. I've known him for years. And speaking of that, have you ever watched any tape of him and Murdoch as the Texas Outlaws?
Oh, great stuff.
Are they amazing or what, man?
One of the more underrated tag teams. It's a shame nobody talks about Dusty Rhodes or Pat Patterson as a member of a tag team, because they were both badass tag teams.
As good as there was. As good as there were whatsoever. Another one you can add in that tag team picture is Nick Bockwinkel. He was also amazing. But Patterson and Ray Stevens were as good a tag team as there ever was invented, quite frankly. And then Dusty and Murdoch in those late 60s, when they were both young and full of piss and vinegar and beer, they were amazing. And I'll tell you, sometimes Vern Gagne is not given the credit for creating the stars that he did and having an eye for talent and booking people in ways that they could draw money and get over, because he paid all the bills. He was a cowboy of his era, his territory. So everything was depending on him. They say, why? I asked Cowboy one time, why do you build everything around yourself? Because I can depend on me. I can't depend on anybody else. Dusty kind of felt that too, I think, to a certain degree.
No, I have no doubt. You know, I mean, you know, it's out there that when everybody was leaving Vern in the AWA, he made Larry Zbyszko the champion because he knew, hey, my family's not going to leave. So right. I can count on him right. to be here. So I don't think that's that unusual, but let's do some rapid fire questions for Dusty. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Hoop wants to know, a lot of people cite Dusty as a big influence in their career. Who were some of Dusty's biggest influences?
Oh man. Whoever was on TV in Houston, on Paul Bosch's television in Houston in the, 50s and 60s. So that would, you know, there's the whole plethora of talents there. I know that he always thought Fritz was a hell of a heel, and to get over as a heel when people know you're Jack Atkinson and played football at TCU and you're purporting to be a Nazi or German sympathizer or whatever. But I think any of that guys in that era, he liked a lot, and he aspired to be. He was an individual. I do think that the Funks, being from West Texas and the Texas natives and being rednecks and cowboys and fitting that stereotypical Texas image, were very, very influential to Dusty. Cause he always talked fondly about Dory Sr. And, yeah. and the boys. So I'd say the Funks are probably as big as anybody.
Clayton Fitch wants to know, of Dusty's many roles in ring talent, commentator, booker, trainer, coach, what was the best role for him if you had to pick just one?
Babyface, a wrestler, cause he can get over with working with anybody. Secondly, probably, his booking. So, but his, as a talent, when he's younger and healthy and all that good stuff that we always talk about, he was hard. He sold tickets, and he, as we said earlier, he was one of the first guys that was just as a Caucasian. He was just as popular with the African American audience and the Hispanic audience as he was with the Caucasian fans. So I think Dusty has a baby face. You know, Cowboy used him very timely. The Superdome shows. I remember one time Bill has some red hot heels, and he put Andre and Dusty together, and everybody in the world knew that they weren't going to win the titles because they're not in the territory. And of course, Cowboys swerved them, and they won the titles, and but it was a big surprise. So Dusty made every card better. He became a great attraction, and and you can thank TBS for a lot of that.
Let's talk a little bit about the common phrases that he used. Paul Rogers wants to know, what was your favorite Dusty call? Something like Funky Like a Monkey, the Hit Maker, the Record Breaker, if you will. Is there a favorite Dustyism that you have?
That's like saying, what's your favorite Beatles song?
Right.
It's good. It's a damn many of them that are good and they're memorable. But what I've just heard there, probably he loved Funky Like a Monkey. He loved talking as if he were an African-American, or he thought an African-American would sound like, because he was so influenced by Muhammad Ali. And as a lot of guys were in that generation, talking trash, saying what's on your mind, being brazen. And he was very brazen as baby faces don't normally brag on themselves. Dusty broke that mold. He bragged on himself all the time. He was pretty. He was tough. He's a champion, all that good stuff. So he broke a lot of molds in that regard on how a babyface positioned himself. Not the humble, soft-spoken, demure babyface. Well, I'm really glad to be here. Excited to be in Oklahoma City on Friday. And then he was belting it out, man. He was up. The volume was up. But I think, he was amazing in that deal. I don't know if I ever heard anybody could do promos for a specific match or a town to make it personal, make you remember where he's going to be and who he's going to be with and when, than Dusty.
Charlie wants to know, and he has a great question, because we get this all the time on Bruce's show. Bruce tells a story about Dusty being, quote, the second most recognizable athlete, second only to Muhammad Ali. Do you have any similar stories or experiences with Dusty? Is that something he said to you a lot?
Oh, of course. He was very self-promotional minded, because again, if you go on television and you tell somebody something you want them to recall or to remember, if you say it enough and you say it with conviction and you're not saying something that's so outlandishly unbelievable that it can't be believed, they normally will believe you. And Dusty was on there, and he would pat himself on the back, and because it was him. And you think back to look at some of those old tapes of Muhammad Ali. He did that. That was his whole shtick. So it worked. It worked in a global way, and it worked in sports. It worked in entertainment. And so Dusty just parlayed that and took it to another level, and it worked out swimmingly.
Dan Kasman wants to know, what is the one quote from Dusty you'll carry with you for life? Not something necessarily said on the microphone, but is there a Dustyism that you sort of still use in your everyday life?
Yeah. If you turn your jersey in, you can't be on the team. And I actually think that could be contributed to Michelle, Dusty's wife. God bless her. You know, she's a spitfire. I love her. She's a Cuban. Hey, he talked about being married to a Cuban when he'd go to Florida. You don't think it didn't work? he's one of us. He don't look like us, but he married one of us. So he's one of us. But I think what it meant was, anytime you quit something, don't be disappointed or be surprised that you failed. You can't quit on projects that mean things to you. You shouldn't quit on anything that you start. You should finish what you start. But basically, it's all summed up in a nutshell. Senna, if you turn in your jersey, you can't be on my team. So it made sense. In his own way, it made a lot of sense. I use that today. I see young talents at seminars and meet and greets and things like that, Conrad. What have I got? I said, you can't quit. You're not going to make any money. You're not going to get rich. You're not right now. But you can't quit. If you quit, you know what the end result's going to be. Not where you want to be. So that was a big thing to me, and I believe that to this day. If you're committed to something, just stay with it. Don't quit. Because the quitting thing just don't work for anybody.
Well, and we hope that you guys don't quit listening to Grill and JR. We're looking forward to next week. We've got the whole schedule of shows coming your way. In the meantime, he is Jim Ross. I'm Conrad Thompson, and we'll see you next week right here on Grill and JR, only on Westwood One.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is that, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah. Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.